There's a mountain over there I gotta climb. There's a sea over there I gotta sail. Think I'll be on the way to break down. Think I feel a hitchhike coming on.
Well, that's by way of introduction to our subject today, hitchhiking. This is Listener's Voices. We take submissions to our responses to our suggested subjects of the week, and we have some stories going way back today. So I'm your host, one of your hosts, Fran. It's joined here by
Francis.
Thank you.
Got a full lineup.
We have a full lineup, so we won't be wasting much time. But we do want to tell people how they can respond. And in fact, we have such a full lineup, we'll probably be sharing some more about hitchhiking in the next episode, 2 weeks from now, on March 1st. So that would be by sending an email to ktwhwriters@gmail.com. And it can be either written or a recorded voice memo from your phone. And we will share it. We take anonymous submissions, and this show will be repeated Monday night at 9 p.m., and then it's also posted on our website, ktwh.org, under the program's drop-down. And a quick preview, the prompt for the next show on March 1st is coincidence, serendipity, synchronicity. Hmm. Three concepts that relate to each other, but not the same. So that'll be interesting to see what comes in from that. But before we launch into hitchhiking fully, we have a belated submission to the fire prompt of the last show. And I'm really happy to share that with you. People are always welcome to respond to previous prompts, and we'll share them as they come in. So this is from an occasional but very valued contributor, Patrick Eller. We'll hear his thoughts on fire.
Strike a match and it bursts into flame. It happens millions of times a day and we take it for granted. Matches are plentiful. They are given away at stores. Matches are relatively inexpensive. Modern answer for the need of the mystery of fire. A match is the beginning of our warmth, the heat that cooks our food, transforming element that reduces that which it consumes to ashes. Life itself has been compared to a flame. As an old saying goes, yesterday is wood, tomorrow is ashes. Only today does the fire burn bright. One of the unanticipated results of inventions that improved the ease and accessibility to the solutions of the needs we have in our life is the easier and more accessible the solution is, the more it is taken for granted, and its mystery and importance are lost on us until we have to do without. Have you ever turned over a canoe on a camping trip and soaked everything? At that point, a match becomes a very valuable commodity. The gift of fire to human beings is the subject of mythology and legend and has always been used as one of the elements that separated us from other beings on Earth, that we learned how to control and use fire for our benefit. Fire is the great transformer, and in many cultures, the mystery and power of fire were considered sacred. The Arabians created the myth of the phoenix, which lived for 500 years and then burned itself in a funeral pyre, only to emerge new and reborn from those ashes. In many cultures around the world, the new year was celebrated with fire. In the times before it was so easy to start a fire by just striking a match, the same fire was kept going for as long as possible once it was lit. The fire was protected and even carried along from place to place in the nomadic tribes. The mystery, utility, and danger of fire out of control were the metaphor to teach the transformative, destructive, and the new beginnings of life. On the last day of the year, there are people who brought out the fire that they had protected and fueled for the past year, and they threw in their possessions, their tools, and other things of value to be consumed by those flames. Whole communities celebrated around this bonfire until it was extinguished and their past reduced to ashes. On the dawning of the first day of the new year, a new fire was kindled. And from that flame, everyone brought home a new light and heat of that beginning. Arising from the ashes of old was made in the creation of new tools and possessions and rebirth in spirit. As I move into the celebration of a new year, I will strike a match and set it to the things of the past to see them transformed. I will stand close enough to feel the heat of them and to look and see what the light from their burning will reveal. From the ashes, a new beginning will emerge and a new fire started, a life reborn, and another chance to discard those things that have become useless. I hope your new year is reasonably joyous and in the warmth and light of a rekindling flame, and your spirit transformed and your life renewed. This is Patrick Geller.
So that was really very timely, actually, that it come this week. This was the week of the first full moon of the Lunar New Year, and I got a video from a friend in Korea of a pyre, I would call it, yes, a big fire that is traditional and used to be traditional in small villages in Korea to have a big fire on the first full moon of the Lunar New Year. And
there's a couple of people in my neighborhood who had bonfires that very night.
All right.
It's not too far away.
Yeah, cool. Okay, well, we will launch into the hitchhiking part of the show, and I have a couple excerpts in the show, one now and then one towards the end, that are from a 1986 cassette tape recording. At that time, three of us, two of my friends and I got together. Actually, my friend Linda Estel called us together because she was taking a class at UMD called Society and the Automobile. And for her final whatever, she made a recording about the history of hitchhiking and then the three of us sharing hitchhiking stories. The sound quality isn't the greatest. We won't be hearing a lot of it, but we will hear Linda's description of the history of hitchhiking. And possibly another episode, we might hear some excerpts directly from that tape. But it was fun. I got some details of stories I had recalled, but had not recalled all the details, so it was fun listening to that. Okay, here's Linda Estel with about the history of hitchhiking.
Weary Willies, disenchanted soldiers from the Civil War, began wandering around the country in the mid-1800s. By the turn of the century, rails had replaced wagons as a means of free transportation. Hobos developed survival systems and set up camps around the country called hobo jungles. While he was scorned by some, he was idolized by others. The hobo was king of the road and lived a free, independent life and was intimately connected with the land. On some level, he clearly expressed an impulse which lay dormant in the hearts of others, an impulse to take life as it comes without expectations or responsibility. The automobile begat another kind of ride beggar, the hitchhiker. Wealthy enough to afford the leisure, carefree enough to yearn for adventure. A group younger and more educated than hobos materialized during the Roaring Twenties. Called gay cats, they traveled as much for pleasure as necessity. They were politically radical and expressed hostility to the status quo. 50 years later, another movement with similar ideas would materialize. Meanwhile, as the country slipped into a depression, people traveled by thumb because there was nothing else to do. Maybe there would be a job in some other town, at least a change of scenery. Old men would hitch home to die. Young women with children would hitch back to what was left of their own secure childhood. The poverty of the times contributed to assaults against hitchhikers. There is no official compilation of crimes against or by hitchhikers. The nomadic lifestyle of the hitchhiker and the mobility of the driver makes both crime and victim difficult to pinpoint. World War II seems to be a turning point as more crimes began to be committed by hitchhikers as the soldiers and sailors took to the road. Gas rationing made hitchhiking a necessity during the time. Giving a soldier a ride was patriotic, part of the victory effort. Drivers were encouraged by the government to give men rides, rather than relying on their own judgment as to the risks involved. After the war, the Beat Generation started gathering in major intellectual and cultural meccas of the country. They denounced the materialism and conservatism of the Eisenhower era and began to grapple with the entry into the nuclear age. For a break, to find themselves and a little excitement, they took to the road. But the masses were not traveling by thumb. Perhaps it was the conservative times, but the travels that Jack Kerouac wrote about weren't a reality for many people. The affluence of the 1960s triggered another wave of hitchhikers. The travelers of the late 60s and early 70s were looking for adventure, as well as a sense of community that could be found on the road.
So, actually, we'll start out with a couple of submissions about local hitchhiking, and then we'll gradually phase into more of the kind of long-distance hitchhiking that introduction was about. So first we'll hear from Leslie about hitchhiking to work.
Hello, it's Leslie with a story about hitchhiking in Milwaukee. It was 1972, and I worked at Hartford Plaza Bank in Chicago. My husband at the time drove a semi for Ruan Transport, also in Chicago. When he was transferred to Milwaukee, I took a job at M&I Bank in downtown. We found an apartment on the bus route in the north 3,000 block of the four-lane one-way going to town, easy enough for me to bus it to and from my job. After a few days, I met an employee at the bank who coincidentally lived right across those four lanes of commuters. We started eating our sack lunches together by the river, and we made a plan to meet right on the bus stop in the morning on the corner where she catches a ride to the bank and avoids paying for the bus. When I approached her there the next morning, I could see her hitchhiking thumb. It was a bit of a surprise to me that her idea of catching a ride meant hitchhiking. Well, from that day on, we easily caught rides to work from the businessmen on their morning commutes. For some reason, I cannot remember a daily hitchhike back home.
Thank you, Leslie. Another use for local hitchhiking was for going to school. Let's hear from, this is submitted in writing by Mary Cartier, I believe is the pronunciation. Some of you may have known her as Mary Clausen.
When I was going to school, we lived in the country with a long driveway. I waited for the bus all those years until I was about 14, I suppose. As a young person, I've always been competitive, played all the sports, just sort of rambunctious in general. I'm not even sure what triggered it specifically. Maybe just a dare to myself, but I started hitchhiking to school and would get picked up pretty much right away before the bus came, and most of the time just driven all the way to school, sometimes getting a bit of a reprimand at the drop-off in front of the school. Mostly I did it to beat the bus, which was the case most of the time. One of these times, however, got me concerned to the degree that I think I certainly changed my habits. I don't recall if I was hitchhiking on the way to school or on the way home from school, but a man in a suit picked me up. He asked if I wasn't worried about who picked me up. I can't say exactly how I reacted to that, but when he slowed down, pulled over, took off his suit coat, and opened the hood, I think I had decided I was done hitchhiking to school. By then, I may have been much closer to getting my driver's license. Thankfully, he was not a killer, kidnapper, or a rapist. I made it through that crazy phase in my life unscathed, but a lot more skeptical of people I would actually get in a vehicle with. Back in those days, yes, it was maybe not safe to be a young girl riding with strangers, but most of the time people would scoop me up almost immediately to get me the heck off the road in order to save me. It worked well for many, many free rides. I was so lucky.
She was. So I meant to issue a disclaimer at the beginning of this show. We are absolutely not endorsing hitchhiking.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Right.
Or did.
Right, yeah. Because it certainly wasn't considered safe then either. But there will have several stories of people taking chances and it coming out all right, although there were some close calls. She had another experience. This is another local story, again from Mary. Let's hear about that mischievousness.
I was in Excelsior area and wanted to go to Hopkins, but I didn't have a vehicle. Not sure how I even got to there. Probably hitchhiked, I guess. Well, I suppose I was old enough to buy a car or test drive one. So I went to a dealer off the Highway 7, down there somewhere, and of course the salesman was eager to sell me something. So I pretended to be interested in a car, and could I test drive it? Sure. So he hops in, and I take off and drive right where I wanted to go, and drop myself off and basically say, "Hey man, thanks for the ride." Boy, was he peeved. I remember laughing my head off after he drove away. That was the meanest one I ever did. But it wasn't that far for him to go back. But I'm sure it was the drive of shame, and he probably got to get humiliated by his peers for it. That's looking at it from the adult perspective, not the willful, skillful kid angle. But hey, no real harm done was just being a brat.
You were, Mary.
Ha, ha, ha.
It's quite some ingenuity there.
Ingenuity.
Those are...
It's a bit risky.
Right. Well, yeah. Those are two suburbs of the Twin Cities, for anybody who may not know, listening. Not that far, but far enough that you didn't want to walk, I guess. So transitioning into the more long-distance type hitchhiking... So when I first was looking for some more content, not knowing how many stories we would get in about hitchhiking, I found on the Internet Archive something called The Hitchhiker's Field Manual. And this is from 1973, right when so much of the stories that we will be hearing about were taking place. It's pretty much the baby boomer generation around my ages, and the late 60s and early 70s is pretty much what I consider the heyday of hitchhiking. And I started reading it, and I realized I think that Linda Estill probably had this same book, probably in hard copy at that time in 1986 when she put together that audio piece we heard at the beginning of the show, because it gives much more detail. But after hearing what she covered, then I decided... Yeah, I didn't have to go into this detail because she gave a good, concise summary of it. But I'll just read the very beginning of it and then share a little bit more of it with you. Every few years, the press rediscovers hitchhiking and seems to think that it has uncovered something new. Feature articles run in the New York Times and Life. A few more people stick out their thumbs. Law enforcement agencies get nervous. The press gets bored and the whole thing dies down after another few years. There are always people hitching, but they are not always noticed. When you hitchhike, you are taking part in a tradition that is as old as civilization. The wanderer has existed as a social type since biblical times, and every age and nation has had its men of the road. And, of course, in our generation, many women of the road as well. This book has 360 pages, so it is a thorough treatment of hitchhiking in the early 1970s. So the headings, beyond the brief history of hitchhiking, planning to hitchhike, hitting the road, such subjects as choosing your spot, hitching in towns and cities, how to dress, passive tactics, other headings, keep on trucking, refusing a ride, stranded, a hunting knife and a little moral courage. I probably suggest how to prepare yourself. Hitchhiking and the Law. And, oh, crashing, as in not in the car, but as places to stay along the way. And then it has a section for every state in the country and what their attitude towards hitchhiking was and how much trouble you could get into it. And just to share what they said about Minnesota. Minnesota is a good state for hitchhikers if you avoid the dead of winter and don't get too far into the hinterlands. Hitching is good in most towns and on most state highways. Interstates are forbidden, of course, but in most areas, warnings precede busts, and in all areas, you may hitch from the ramps. Hitchhiking illegally in Minnesota is a petty misdemeanor, which means you cannot receive a jail sentence. Minnesota contains 15,292 large lakes. I wouldn't say they're all large, but we do have a lot of lakes. If you are there in summer, there will be ample opportunity for swimming, a good respite from the dusty road. This is one reason why summer is the time to be in Minnesota. Another reason is that winters are cold and very snowy. Duluth averages a daily low of 1 degree below zero in January, not counting the wind chill factor. Summer hitching is fun and easy. Minnesota police take a pragmatic attitude towards young travelers. The degree of enforcement, says the state police, is dependent on the adverse effect violations may have upon the safe and expedient movement of affected vehicles and pedestrians. So, and then they list a few cities within Minnesota and what resources they might provide for the hitchhiker. So, quite the thorough treatment there. So, let's see what we have to get back to then. Here's another story from Leslie of a long-distance hitchhiking experience.
Hello, it's Leslie, and I'm here with a story about my sister's hitchhiking experience. In May 1975, my first husband and I gave birth to our son, Caleb. We were so happy to have him, as it had taken an entire year to get pregnant. My younger sister, Deborah, had always reminded me of W.C. Fields, who said, "Any man who hates dogs and children can't be all bad." But when she heard that it was a difficult time for me with sore nipples, a colicky baby, and garden planting season hanging over me, she decided to come. Sounds easy enough, right? Not. She lived in New York City, and my first husband and I had rented a tiny farmhouse in rural Iowa. None of us had travel money for Deb. Remember, this was 1975. She decided to hitchhike. Today, she sent me an email of the retelling of her experiences. So this is her email to me. I took a subway to New York City up to the George Washington Bridge, where I walked across the bridge when it was 95 degrees. I didn't even have any water. That bridge was actually Interstate 80 that came 5 miles from your house in Iowa. In about 15 minutes, standing out there, two nice guys about age 25 on their way to California picked me up and said they'd take me to your home and then be on their way. Halfway, they set up a tent, we snacked on something, they fell asleep, and I was so scared they were going to rape me or harm me, even though they seem really nice. Anyway, in the morning, we were on our way, and they did drop me off at your house and left after they spent the night on the floor. A week later, to get home, you dropped me off on Interstate 80, where a young couple picked me up. They asked me for money, and I told them to drop me off at the next exit. They did. Shortly after, a semi-trucker picked me up and took me all the way back to New York City and over the George Washington Bridge, where I took the subway back down to my apartment.
So she was lucky.
That's adventurous, yes.
Right, yeah. And I have a story I probably won't share till next time about spending much longer than you expect with some people. I ended up spending a day and a half with some people that I totally did not expect to. They had picked me up, but then I ended up doing most of the driving. It's a long story that I
will look forward to hearing
share
it.
Next time. Right. So, yeah, you never know. Another time, there are a couple of stories about trust. I mean, that's built into this whole thing. You have to have judgment and trust to a judgment about when to trust.
Who to let drive by and who to get in the car with.
Right. It would be interesting to read that little chapter on refusing a ride in the field manual. But next, we will hear from Doris, who has more than one story. This is not from the 1986 recording. She was there for that recording, but this was a fresh recording of yet another story that was new to me.
How I started hitchhiking. I was in Southern California in 1973. I had been on a sailboat sailing the Polynesian islands of the South Pacific for the last 6 months. It was a dream of a lifetime, if you consider a 20-year-old to have a right to use the word a lifetime. But at any rate, I loved it, and I wanted to sail for the rest of my life. But the boat came into port, and we knew that it would be in dry dock for a couple of weeks. And one of my shipmates said, "Hey, you want to hitchhike across the country?" Well, the adventure of being at sea lured me into thinking, why not another adventure? And he said to me, he says, "I think we would make better progress if we went together, you know, a guy and a girl. And then, you know, maybe people would be shy about picking up a single guy." Well, I wanted to give it a try, and here was my opportunity. So, wouldn't you know, we talked to a few people, and we found out the best place to start a transcontinental hitchhike was the last exit from the L.A. area in San Bernardino. So when we got there, we found out a lot of people decided that was the right place to hitchhike across the United States, and there was probably five other people at this freeway exit. Some of them looked, you know, downright like grubby hippies, and they usually got picked up by someone with a van that didn't look like it was in top shape either. But we stuck it out. We were there for 5 hours and getting a little discouraged, and finally we got a ride. We got a ride, actually, to a two-lane highway, Needles. I think it's in Arizona. It was the middle of the night by then, and I thought to myself, this is the desert. There were bugs crawling all over every square inch of the desert where we were trying to hitchhike. We decided to stop standing, and we started walking down the road where there weren't many lights, and we were hitchhiking. There was, you know, I wouldn't say steady, but there was traffic. And wouldn't you know it, a semi pulled up, you know, maybe 100 yards ahead of us. And so we're like, finally, let's go get that ride. And we both started running. I had a great big old pack with me. And so the guy was ahead of me by at least 50 feet or something like that when he got up to the passenger door of this semi that was pulled over on the side of the road. And as he came up to the passenger door, the driver walked around the front of the truck, hit him really hard, and got back in his truck and drove off. Well, after that, we were a lot more cautious about the kind of rides we got, but to be honest, there weren't that many offers of rides. Finally, we did get a lift. By this time, it was, oh, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning. We got to a truck stop someplace in New Mexico or something like that. And my partner said, you know, we're not getting rides as a couple. He says, I think I'm going to do better if I just go off on my own. He said, I'm going to start asking around for a ride just for myself. Well, I was furious. I couldn't believe that he had no sense of obligation, left me, single woman, with this big pack in the middle of the night, in the middle of the country, without really resources to go home except hitchhiking alone. Well, I was pretty and I just started to walk away to the exit sign for the truck stop. And what you know, an RV pulled up next to me and said, are you hitchhiking? Or I think I had stuck my hand out, you know, and he's pulled over and he said, are you hitchhiking? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, the Midwest. I'm heading for Wisconsin. And he said, are you alone? Meanwhile, my partner saw this RV pull up. He raced up and stood next to me when this guy asked the question, are you alone? And I said, Yes. He said, well, I'm not taking anybody but just one person. He says, you can get in. And he said, are you with that guy? And I said, no. And I got in the RV and we had a really nice ride. You know, it was more than 24 hours together, day and night. Of course, you know, people who picked you up in the middle of the night were looking for someone to talk to so they wouldn't fall asleep. And he drove me, you know, through the green fields of Kansas and I think Illinois, and he ended up dropping me off at a truck stop in Terre Haute, Indiana, and I got a lift from a, it wasn't a, I don't know how to describe it. It was a semi-truck that made a lot of noise and had no passenger seat. He said, well, they take that seat out to discourage us from picking up hitchhikers. But anyway, I put my great big old pack on the floor and I sat on it and I nearly lost every tooth in my head because literally with that vehicle, you could bounce up to the ceiling. Anyway, so that's how I got home the first time. And believe it or not, it was so exciting. I hitchhiked back to Southern California to get back on the boat.
Wow. I hadn't heard, I know Doris pretty well. She's a good friend of mine, and that was all news to me. Quite the adventurer. So we may look forward to another story from Doris next time, if time permits, because there are more hitchhiking stories, and we have time to fit in here. Let's see. Next up is Francis has a hitchhiking story. And picking up hitchhiking stories, so we'll hear from you next.
I was born in the late 60s, and in my family, it was understood that hitchhiking was not a good idea, and that we were never to do it. That said, every once in a while, we'd have a summer vacation. We'd be driving up and down the coast of California, and we would pick up somebody who was hitchhiking, and they all turned out to be very nice people. One of them was a school teacher, and she spent her summer break hitchhiking around the country. As a matter of fact, she stayed with us for 2 days and instituted rules, behavior patterns for three children to follow. My parents thought it was very funny. One of them was that there would be no gum chewing while we were driving. I thought that was interesting. So I've only had one actual hitchhiking experience. I was hiking a portion of the Pacific Crest Trail, and I had separated from my friends. Either I was going too slow or they were going too fast. Either way, we jogged ahead or behind each other quite a bit. But when I got to the end of the trailhead for the town of Julian, I knew I was going to have a long roadwalk ahead of me and probably alone. So I turned the corner, saw the trailhead parking lot there, and there was a van with its back doors wide open. And a half dozen of my friends were waving me on and encouraging me to hurry up and get in. And so I ran and I caught up with the van. I jumped in, somebody closed the back door and took us to town. Now, when I looked back on it and realized what I had done, gotten into the back of a van, even with all my friends, and had the door closed by somebody I didn't know, it makes me laugh because it could have gone very differently in the mind of fear. But anyway, that's my only hitchhiking experience. And I'd love to have been born in a time that it was common practice and that so many of us we're doing it because I think there's a lot more good out there in the world than there is bad. It's the bad apples that spoil the pot.
Yeah, that's for sure. And as we said earlier, we're not condoning this, recommending it at all.
No, it's far too risky in this day and age.
Yeah.
Now that we have movies that show us all the terrible things that could happen to you.
And none of all the good stuff. There's stories to come. Some of them are in my head. I'm not sure how many we'll hear, but of really good experiences on the road at that time. And at least one or two of them we'll have to wait for next week, I know. But this is another kind of cautionary tale. I called my high school, not high school, college roommate a couple of weeks ago so we could compare notes on our recollection of a trip we made. And this is an excerpt from that conversation, which ended up being quite long. And I managed to trim this part down to 5 minutes, and we might hear some more excerpts another time. But we were young and naive, or new to hitchhiking and naive, and learned one important lesson that we'll share with you now. We should give a little context to this adventure. So Peg and I had been roommates in college, and I don't remember how we discovered this volunteer opportunity, to spend the summer at Grand Teton National Park with the Student Conservation Association. Mm-hmm. And so we both managed to get accepted for the summer to live in Jackson Hole and be kind of information consultants, I guess, at the visitor center.
Sort of jack of all trades, really.
So we won't spend too much time on that, but the problem was getting out there from, well, I had been in school in Ann Arbor, and when we were in Minneapolis after the end of the school year and needed to get out to Jackson Hole, I guess because we had no money for an alternative, but we decided we had to hitchhike to get out there. And this was 1969. So I thought it would be fun to compare notes of what we remember about our adventure getting out to Jackson Hole. And then there was a side trip during the summer out to Seattle and back, and then the trip home. So I'll start out with the beginning of it, because it involves my mother. And unbeknownst to her, she facilitated this whole thing by giving us a ride down to the downtown bus station in Minneapolis, thinking that she was dropping us off to pick up our bus to go out to Wyoming. And we waited for long enough to know that she would have gotten out of downtown and on her way back home. And then I think maybe we took a city bus to the edge of town. Do you recall?
This part I don't remember at all. And I think we were really lucky that your mother didn't decide to just wait to see us off on the bus.
Right. I'm kind of thinking we might have known which city bus to take to get at least to the edge of a suburb or something. But
maybe so.
Yeah. And I have a memory of how things went very generally from then. But where do you pick up on your memory of the whole affair?
Well, I remember one of the things that I, you know, this was the first time that I had been west of the western boundary of Minnesota. So the west part of the country was all new territory for me.
One thing I want to back up to that I remember well from the day of hitchhiking to get us to Bozeman, I think it would have been, that we commented at the time on how funny it was that each ride we got was a bigger vehicle. For example, it would have been like we first got a ride in a regular sedan kind of car, and then a station wagon, and then some kind of camper van. And then the ultimate, we thought we'd really struck gold, which turned out to kind of backfire on us.
But, the semi-truck.
The moving van, yes. It was a moving van, a red
was
dot.
Was it a moving van?
It absolutely was. I remember Red Dot is the name of it. So we learned the first lesson a person should know about hitchhiking, which is absolutely not advised to do, so don't bother to learn the lesson. But don't get separated from your gear. And we had no idea. So we let them put our packs in the back of the moving van part of the van. There were two drivers. And and then they stashed us up in the sleeping nook.
Yeah, the overhead sleeping compartment.
Right.
In the cab.
In the cab, right. Yeah, we were behind them. And there's some more details we won't go into. But by the time it's getting to be dusk, and they took us a long way. I think all of Montana probably, which is huge. And we are not comfortable with them by this point. They really wanted us to stay with them. So it wasn't as far as where you turned down to go down to Yellowstone. It was somewhere short of that. And they knew we were wanting to get to Yellowstone, and they wanted us to stay with them. And we were very uncomfortable with them by that point. And I think just probably because of, you know, wanting to protect their jobs, they didn't want to jeopardize their jobs by taking us captive. So the sun was, you know, it was already at dusk, and we were in this city, which I'll try to look it up on a map and remember what that would have been. But they finally just relented, and I remember going to the back of the moving van, and they opened it up and gave us our packs, and my legs were shaking as we were walking down the street. I was so relieved to get our stuff back and be independent of them, and that just, I think, gave us a good scare. So the fun thing about having listened to that tape from 1986 when I shared that story was being reminded of some details. We had spent the night in the Dakotas somewhere. I was thinking it was all one big long day, but we camped someplace in the Dakotas, and then these movers picked us up first thing the next morning and spent the whole day. And so it was Billings that they dropped us off in, which is just a little short of Livingston, which is where you turn to go down to Yellowstone. So if anybody has Montana in their mind and is trying to figure this out.
Glad you made it.
Yeah, really. Yep. So that was very naive of us to have gotten separated from our gear. So moving right along here, we have a couple of more really excellent stories to share. And next we have Richmond. And then we will have a submission from Patrick after that, but we'll hear a little from Mary Clausen in between there. Okay, here's from Richmond.
Hello, this is Richmond, responding to the KTWH Listener's Voices prompt, Hitchhiking, with title being The Hopeful Thumb. Sticking out a thumb, walking backwards, and then when a car stops, you turn around and with a committed pace, get to and get in the vehicle. Sometimes the driver would wait until I and whoever I was with were right up to the side of the vehicle. Then they would speed off, spinning their wheels, raising a cloud of whatever was on the road, loose enough to fly. That we didn't much like either. It wasn't a spontaneous revelation, whereby realizing that I could do this hitchhiking thing, thumbing it, and that in doing so, it would carry me at least part way to whatever destination was on my menu. I had to learn it from somewhere, from someone. That someone was my best friend and neighbor, Alan. He was a year older, so with my being 12, that would make him 13, which is not a big age difference for having an edge in the category of certain life experiences, but he did have that edge, and he had an older brother, Jim, who was 17. I suspected that is where Alan, I think, learned about hitchhiking. So Alan told me all about hitchhiking, which sounded both scary and fun. It was within a couple of days that we each told our parents we were sleeping over at the other's house. It really worked. And then, one afternoon, we walked out to the nearest highway, Minnesota Highway 65, where we stuck out our hopeful thumbs with hope to hitch a ride to Ham Lake Campground. Why the Ham Lake Campground? I've no recollection of why Alan chose this destination for our first epic hitchhiking experience, but we headed out, and as I recollect, with no food or water, and maybe some pocket change. It took forever, it seemed, to get to Ham Lake Campground. It was 60 miles, all of them on Minnesota Highway 65. We did get there, though. What I remember is that we got to the campground well after dark. We were tired, thirsty, hungry. There's vending machines in this reminiscence. I think we had enough change for a bottle, glass bottle of Coca-Cola. Alan said, we'll split it in half. Your half is on the bottom. My half is on the top. Okay, yeah, I said. Then he says, I drink my half first. Guzzle, guzzle, guzzle. It was dark. There was a picnic table. The sky was clear. Being away from city lights, the stars were bright. The two of us, we just laid out on that picnic table, looking up at those amazing stars, and we talked about whatever it was 12 and 13-year-old boys talk about, circa 1964, till around the early 80s, when I would have been about 28. That was when the hopeful thumb retired. I've named it the hopeful thumb because that with every vehicle approaching and passing, there's the hope that this could be the one. Hitchhiking was good to me. I'd only had one or two concerning rides, concerning for my safety. Each resolved favorably with the driver stopping and letting me out. Hitchhiking also means walking, walking and walking, and sometimes late into the night on vacant asphalt, rolling out the miles with no one for company but the stars and the smell of country air, destinations from and within Minnesota to Pensacola, Florida, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Louisiana, Alabama, Arkansas, Rochester, Minnesota, St. Cloud, Minnesota, and the family farm with the driveway at the Minnesota Highway 65 mile marker 152, Minneapolis to Swan River, Minnesota, 152 miles. I made that trip countless times. Hitchhiking was part of the culture I grew up in. It felt mostly safe. If I was in the city, wanted to go somewhere and didn't have a vehicle, hitchhike. Want to go to Florida? Hitchhike. Would I hitchhike now? In an emergency situation, stranded with a mechanical breakdown on a country road, miles from nowhere, would I ever pick up a hitchhiker? Yes, I did pick up hitchhikers. Sometimes on a long road trip, one wishes for company. Other times, you just want to help someone out because you know what it's like to be on the road sticking out your thumb. Your hopeful thumb. If I were heading somewhere up the North Shore or surrounding areas, if I saw someone hitchhiking, I may stop and offer a ride. If they were backpacking, that would make it more likely. There's many considerations and decisions that have to happen very quickly before committing to picking up a hitchhiker. Many considerations. Now, as I think back to adventures, thumbing it, there's a Cat Stevens song comes to mind. Miles from nowhere. Miles from nowhere. Guess I'll take my time. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. To reach there. Look up at the mountain. I have to climb, oh yeah, to reach there. Lord, my body has been a good friend, but I won't need it when I reach the end.
Thank you for reminding us of that song, Richmond, and you have been around. Different practice for guys. There still are still safety issues, but
it was regularly accepted that it was okay for guys back in the day.
Right. And it's true, we don't see hitchhikers much
I don't
at
see
all.
Them.
Yeah, all except maybe that he had that example of along, you know, an area where people are
a little bit in Oregon. It
really?
Still exists a little bit in Oregon, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I haven't seen one for many years. I think we'll go right into the closing here with Patrick's submission. We have a couple more short pieces from Mary, formerly Mary Clausen, but I think we'll save those for next week, partly about picking up hitchhikers. And we have another story to go with that. So just to make sure we get this in here. And then that will go right into Linda's conclusion from her production in 1986 for her Automobiles and Society course. I was really moved by this submission of Patrick's. I must have had a very similar experience, I guess, as far as the place that he describes. And it just was very dear to my heart. So thank you, Patrick, for this. Actually, it's I believe he originally produced it about 10 years ago, and I do want to mention that cellist Kathy McTavish, former resident of Clover Valley, is also heard on this production. It's kind of he's a sound artist, much like Richmond in the productions he has done. Here is Patrick Eller.
This essay represents a time in my life that I sometimes miss. I do not miss not having a home or a family, and honestly, the road can be very hard. But there are moments of acceptance and a clarity on the road that are intensely personal and defining. And that's about all I can tell you, unless you already know. Roads. I'm not sure why, but right now I recall a warm summer night hitchhiking on a two-lane state road a mile north of a small Iowa town. It was about 1 a.m. and a breeze high up in the cottonwoods sounded like a sudden rain squall on still water. The warm night air near the ground was still, the sky warm and thick with July. The crickets kept an ancient rhythm that the spirits of that place still danced with, dreamt with. The surrounding distant yard lights seemed to be in some strange grid spreading out in every direction. A hazy orange dome of light hung over the little town. The bright amber points of street lights stood in a single line on Main Street. Three white concrete elevators rose above their glow. And in the darkness above, a silent red light blinked in slow motion. On, then off, then on again. Do you know the smell of a warm summer's night in farm country? Growing corn tasseling, alfalfa flowering, the cottonwood's sweet perfume, the new mown ditch, the day's heat still in the pavement, the smell of rain somewhere off in the southwest. The pastures and swamps where little creeks flow through peat and cattails, and the smells rise to meet you like a cool, damp ghost. I had been hearing a sound, a bell-like sound that was muffled and cut short, not allowed to ring out. The sound came to me on slow breezes. I wondered what it was. The silence would settle back in, and my attention would wander down that dark road with all the world apparently asleep. Cooled down around 3 a.m., not many cars had passed and none had stopped. And I was just wrapping a blanket around myself and leaning against my pack when I heard that bell sound again drifting in and out on the breeze. I wanted to sleep. I was under the peaceful spell of that place. I was very tired, but I understood some of the crickets' rhythm, and I knew some of the spirits' dance. And that bell was a call to dream, played by beings I could not see, but to whom I am eternally grateful. And before I fell asleep, I saw the morning star. Across a large field of soybeans to the northeast, a young sow nudged the metal cover of a feeder open, ate its fill, and turned to walk to the water. And the cover of the feeder clanged down again, and the sound was that of a bell that is muffled before it stops ringing.
And so hitchhiking provided for us what it provided to the hobos and to the weary willies. It provided a chance to take life as it comes, to travel the highways and not have the responsibility of a car, to take the risks and meet other people, learn to trust people, and see the country.
When the mist rolls in on Highway 1, like a curtain to the day, a thousand silhouettes hold out their thumbs, and I see them, and I say, you are my children, my sweet children, I'm your poet.
Ah, well, I have to say,
a romantic conclusion.
Yeah. More than once during the production of this show, I was moved to tears. And some of it is maybe material you won't hear until next week, or you might not hear at all. But hearing that Joan Baez song kind of, it just really takes me back to that era. And so we are out of time. I really thank everyone who's contributed to this episode. And as we've said, there will be more next time in 2 weeks, I believe. The prompt for the March 1st episode is coincidence, synchronicity, serendipity. So we invite you to submit your responses to that to ktwhwriters@gmail.com. And hopefully people will have thoughts on it and experiences of it to share with us.
Indeed.
See you again in a couple of weeks. Thank you, Frances, for being here.
Thank you, Fran.